LibroFM lets you purchase audiobooks directly from your favorite local bookstore. Choose from more than 150,000 audiobooks, including New York Times bestsellers and recommendations from booksellers around the country. With LibroFM, you'll get the same audiobooks at the same price as the largest audiobook company out there. You know what one we're talking about, but you'll be part of a much different story, one that supports community.
If you're new to audiobooks, they're the perfect way to get more books into your busy life. Listen while doing chores, walking the dog, or just relaxing at home. All you need is a smartphone and the free LibroFM app.
If you already love audiobooks and don't know what to listen to next, check out recommendations and curated lists from the people who know audiobooks best, local booksellers.
Listeners of the Bookstore Podcast can get a 2-month audiobook membership for the price of 1 month.
Go to Libro.fm, that's Libro.fm, and enter bookstore at checkout. With each listen, take pride in knowing that you're supporting local bookstores.
Welcome to the Bookstore.
It's like a book club, but we actually read the book.
I'm Becca.
And I am Corinne. I think we've got a little... Do we want to talk about this news up top? I mean, there's been a lot of book news, so we might have to do more in-depth discussion of things soon.
I did want to note one thing, and this is because I've talked about this author a lot on the podcast and recommended her. She's been my favorite author for a long time, and that is Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. She recently said that J.K. Rowling was right about trans people, and apparently she's actually had a history of being transphobic, which I did not know.
That you don't endorse those thoughts.
Yeah. Yes, I do not. I'm not going to be engaging with her work anymore. That's my choice, but I just wanted to say it because I do feel a little bit bad for not... researching what she believes, because apparently she has history of making these kind of remarks, and I didn't know that. Akweke Emezi, which we read for the podcast before we read their book Pet, they have a good thread on Twitter about it, and just about how, you know, your heroes, like, you don't always have to keep your heroes the same heroes. Like, if they make mistakes or if they do something you don't agree with, like, it's okay to ignore them. Take what you learn from them, and then you just don't have to engage with them anymore. And yeah, so I just wanted to say that because I know I've mentioned Adichie on this podcast before. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, unfortunately, like, the way that it happens to be with people, and I mean, just like in general, you can't know every single thing about them, obviously. Yeah. So I think... I don't know. And maybe this is just something that I've been trying to practice too, is just like being more kind to yourself on that. Because like, you can't know every person's opinion on all of those things. And you can only make decisions once you learn that sort of information. So yeah, I mean, it sucks that Adichie believes those things. And we know that now moving forward.
Yeah. Growing and learning, and leaving the people who refuse to grow and learn in the past.
Yes. All right. This week we read Murder at the Vicarage by Agatha Christie. It took us a while to pick it out, so that may come as a surprise to you, but that's what we read. Shall we get into the summary?
Yeah. So Murder at the Vicarage was published in 1930, and it was Christie's first novel to feature amateur detective Miss Marple and Miss Marple's village of St. Mary Mead. It is written in first person from the perspective of the vicar, Leonard Clement. Leonard is married to Griselda, who is considerably younger than him, and they live with his nephew, Dennis, in this small, quaint English village of St. Mary Mead. The murder, from the title, is that of Colonel Protheroe. He is a much disliked local man. His body is discovered by the vicar in his study in the vicarage. I won't go into the plot too much because it kind of unfolds like probably most of these sort of cozy detective mysteries, as people walk around, interview people, find out more information, And then at the end, the detective, whoever it is of the story, you know, explains exactly how everything happened. And of course, in this novel, that detective is Miss Marple, who is an elderly spinster. She is somehow always present, always kind of knows what's going on. And of course, in the end, she explains what the police did not find out.
Yes. So, I mean, we probably will be spoiling it as we move through this. If you are somehow like me, didn't know about this book or this 90-year-old story, then maybe you should take caution with that. But otherwise, we will be proceeding. So you've read Agatha Christie before.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you read a lot of them as a younger person.
I read the Hercule Poirot ones. I never really got into the Miss Marple ones, but yes.
Okay. Yeah. I have only read And Then There Were None, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So this one's actually quite different from And Then There Were None, which is, I believe, standalone anyway. It's not part of a series. One thing I will say I was surprised about with this is that I assumed for like a series called like the Miss Marple books or whatever, that it would be literally following Miss Marple as she did all of the detective work. But really, she's kind of a side character. And as you said, it's narrated by the vicar of the village. So I was surprised by that. I don't know. What did you think?
Yeah, I was surprised too. So from my recollection, I think that the Poirot ones are mostly like Poirot, and then he's got like a sidekick, kind of like a Watson to his Holmes, who, and then the sidekick narrates it. But I could be totally wrong. It's been a very, very long time since I've read them.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was very surprised that it was the vicar narrating it. And I also thought that he was the murderer because he was narrating it. And I was like, what an interesting twist that would be.
Yeah. So, I mean, what did you think of him as a character? Because I think he's really, I don't know, he's sort of weird. So I'd just like to get your take. Or maybe you didn't think about him much at all. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, he's it's a funny character to have. I think it's interesting whenever there's a lot of like older people in it, because he is, I think I read him as being like literally in his 70s.
Yeah, I have no idea, because I think like there's sometimes where he basically says that he's elderly because he's married to a 25-year-old woman, Griselda, and I know that he's like significantly older than her, but I don't know if it's like one of those like old timey parlances kind of like where it's like elderly, but it's, he's really just like, I don't know, 50 or whatever.
Right. Well, like, yeah.
When I think elderly, I think like geriatric. So I don't know.
Yeah. He's like, he is like the fun version of the Reverend from Gilead. Marilyn Robinson's Gilead, because he's married to a younger, this is like the fun couple.
Except for that he's like incredible, he's just sort of incredibly boring. You don't really know much about him except for that like sometimes he's kind of a buzzkill. I did like that over the course of the story he became like sort of cheekier. So I appreciated that about him, but like the way that Griselda talks about him sometimes is just, I never ceases to marvel me like how marriages must have been back in the day, where like you didn't know shit about your partner and they were like a complete mystery to you. I don't know, some of the things that get said are just really crazy.
Yeah. And I highlighted because I read this as an ebook from the library, which was kind of nice because it was easy to highlight.
Right.
And so I actually highlighted part of when he first starts talking about her. He says, "I've always been of the opinion that a clergyman should be unmarried. Why I should have urged Griselda to marry me at the end of a 24 hours acquaintance is a mystery to me." So they got married after only knowing each other for 24 hours.
It's wild. And so I don't know when they got married either, if this is like a fairly new thing or not. But yeah, I have these parts highlighted. I also read this as an ebook. I should probably read all of our books as ebooks because I'm much more likely to make notes.
Mm-hmm, but same.
also hate ebooks for reasons I'll maybe discuss shortly. But so this is much later. This is like towards the end of the book. She says he is just given this like crazy sermon at the church where he's like evangelizing and like calling out people and telling them that they're guilty and they must, you know, repent or whatever. Mm-hmm. And she says, Len, you were rather terrible tonight. I didn't like it. I've never heard you preach like that before. And then she goes on to say, he says, you know, what, I don't expect you'll ever hear that from me again. And she says, like, what made you do this? And he's like, I don't know. It's nothing special, basically. And she goes, I wondered, that was all. You're very unexpected, Len. I never feel like I really know you. just like such an insane thing to say to a person you're married to. I don't know.
Well, yeah. And the way he talks about her, so like he describes her as, okay, let me see. Griselda is nearly 20 years younger than myself. She is most distractingly pretty and quite incapable of taking anything seriously. She is incompetent in every way and extremely trying to live with. And I mean, it's very funny to read that, but it's also like, I don't know, hilarious to think of, like, why Christie was writing that.
Okay, so she's nearly 20 years younger than mm-hmm. him. Is that what he said? Okay, yes. So he's in his late 40s. Okay, so that's not quite as bad as it seemed at some points when I couldn't really remember what he said about their ages. But yeah.
Yeah.
And then there's other times where she's just like, I don't, she'll just be like, maybe I'll take up a lover.
Yeah.
Essentially. Like, very funny to me too. I don't know. So anyway,
that's kind of like the whole way the book is written. It is, I forgot how funny it is and how funny I found it, which is part of the reason I think that I liked these books so much when I was uh-huh. younger. It's just full of like sort of goofy things. Like the vicar is thinking about how everybody in the village like knows what's going on because everybody, it's very much like this is a sleepy village. So if you forget your hat one day, you're going to have like five spinsters that notice that you forgot your hat.
Right.
And he says, it is a mystery to me how anyone ever gets any nourishment in this place. They must eat their meals standing up by the window so as to be sure of not missing anything. And that yeah. is sort of the enjoyable part of reading how Christie writes, is it's just sort of like, I don't know, very funny.
It's funny because like I think the vicar is in some ways very much like the least interesting character in the mm-hmm. book. He is funny and he has funny observations, but aside from that, he doesn't have like a ton of personality. But I guess that works because then he's able to just remark on a town full of personalities, so that's sort of fun. What should we move on to?
Well, so sort of the way I read this and the way I know I've read when I was very into Christie's books, I read them, is I didn't really try to figure out who did it and right. how it happened, which is kind of interesting reading it because I realized there's so many characters and I really uh-huh. couldn't always remember who was who.
No, absolutely could
and who
not.
Was doing what and what, how they related to each other. And it just got to be too much. Like I totally forgot who the archers were.
Oh yeah. And this is like very likely part of my just like mental state in general right now, but like I couldn't commit like a single name to memory in this book. And so like except for Lettice, and Lettice I could only remember really because I was like I kept thinking like how easy it would be to pronounce her name Lettuce, so like I
oh I did that's yeah. I couldn't, like, Lettuce walks into the room. Okay. Yeah.
She came in through the window. We should talk about that, too, in a minute. But
yes.
Yeah, so I really struggled with names. Like, at one point, he's speaking to somebody's maid, I think. It's the Protheros. And her name is Gladys. And there's another Gladys. And I'm like, you can't honestly be doing this to me right now. I do appreciate putting two Gladyses in the same book and giving them both speaking parts. But just because, like, that's how real life is, not everybody has their own perfectly unique name. But, oh, man, like, in terms of allowing me to keep the name straight, not in my favor with this one.
Yeah.
I didn't know who Hawes was at a certain point. I wasn't even sure who Dennis was sometimes. So.
Yeah, I forgot who Dennis was and started getting him confused with Lauren. I got all the police inspectors confused.
Oh, yeah.
Hawes and one of the police. I thought Hawes was part of the police for a while. That being said, it wasn't bad to read. It's just for such a plot, the book is all about just the plot and figuring out what happened. So you don't really ever get to know anybody.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's the problem with having so many named characters and then with the same name.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. One thing I thought was interesting was how often, like, different detective stories would get brought up. It just made the book seem, like, really self-aware, which I think added to the air of, like, it's kind of more, like, lighthearted and funniness, like, despite it being a detective story and about a murder. So, yeah, it was interesting to see, like, Sherlock Holmes and, like, Arthur Conan Doyle were name-dropped several times. And then somebody talks about G.K. Chesterton because of the types of theories that this one character was, you know, putting forth. And mm-hmm. I just thought that was really interesting because now, obviously, like, Agatha Christie is just, like, she's more famous than G.K. Chesterton. So I just thought that was funny.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And also, it's funny because I wonder how many detective stories were more lighthearted in this way. And, like, partially we chose to read this because we were looking for something quote unquote cozy. But yeah, I mean, it's just, I don't know, just interesting.
Well, and it's interesting too about, like, why it's cozy, because I kind of always thought cozy mysteries are that because they're set in these, you know, villages like St. Mary Mead, and uh-huh. every character is a bit kooky. But I think it's also because the victim is, I'm betting that the victim's usually, like, a bad person. So you don't ever get from the story that you're supposed to feel bad for the person who was murdered at all. In this one, Colonel Prothrow, everybody hated him.
Yeah.
So we don't know anything about him other than nobody liked him.
Right. Yeah. It was interesting too. Yeah. That, like, the characters often had, like, preoccupations with true crime. There's a point where Griselda even says something like, it's so boring around here. What I wouldn't give for, like, a murder or a burglary or something like that. And people, like, found it very exciting that someone had been murdered, which is sort of, you know, outside of this context, like, a very weird and gruesome thing. But also maybe, mm-hmm. you know, Miss Marple would say so human nature, because obviously, like, true crimes are, or true crime is, like, one of the hottest podcast topics in the world. So I don't know. It's just sort of funny how, like, that doesn't change, but, like, also how this book written in the 30s or whatever by a British woman is just kind of very forthcoming about how people get, like, tantalized by murder and mayhem.
Yeah, I mean, and even the vicar expresses the thought that he would like to kill Colonel Prothero.
Yeah. Terrible, but it's not true, so I guess that's fine.
So you mentioned lettuce and how she goes through windows. I actually highlighted a part where it's towards the end and she comes in to see the vicar and he says, it's described as, she drifted through my study window, mm-hmm. wraith-like as ever. And here's my question, because I've read this before in older books where people come through windows.
I think I have an explanation. So
it can't be a real, like, a window like I have where you throw up the sash and then they are, like, hopping in.
But, like, that is all I can imagine, is, like, Mrs. Marple, like, crawling up, like, over a windowsill yes. into a room and, like, ducking her head down to get in. No, but I think I think probably what they're talking about is what we would call, like, French doors. That's my guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, like, every single time it was mentioned, I'm just, like, thinking about this old woman, like, crawling through a window. So the best kind of comedy. Oh, your English is different than our English.
So I don't know. How do you want to go?
Yeah,
this?
I have no idea. I don't think I could even, like, really take you through the plot. Like, obviously I know what happened, but I think what's funny about these types of books, because I've not read much Agatha Christie before, as I mentioned, but like I've read 10 books by Alan Bradley, the Flavia Deluce mysteries, and they're basically the exact same formula, right? Like there's all of this stuff that happens, and then at the very end, someone just is like, here is exactly how it went down, and everyone's like, there's absolutely no other way it could have happened, and then it's over. Mm-hmm. So like, I think it's just funny, because you reading it, like, I don't know how you could ever fully put it together to guess. Maybe you could. Maybe yeah. I'm stupid. But I don't know. I don't know if there's much point in me explaining like step by step what happened, right? You know what I mean? So I don't know how we want to proceed. Stick out to you in the way that the story was told, I guess.
I guess one thing that I did find interesting is like there's all of these spinsters in mm-hmm. this village, or maybe some of them are widows. I can't remember exactly, but I think it's interesting that everybody thinks that they're all just sort of busybodies in getting in people's business, when really in the case of Miss Marple and a few others, they're actually very observant
yeah.
and very smart, to the point where the murderers have to account for that. So like one of the things is, again, these are spoilers, Anne Prothero goes without her handbag and makes sure that Miss Marple sees her without her handbag, because she wants Miss Marple to know that she doesn't have a weapon.
Right.
But then Miss Marple recognizes that it's extremely weird for her to be without her handbag, because women always have handbags.
Right.
And so then that like clues Miss Marple in to suspect Anne Prothero.
Right. Yeah. I really liked how, because I mean, I think it's really easy for like a lot of writers or whatever to just, I also like how Agatha Christie sort of like slid in these like underhanded sexist things, you know, by certain characters. And I liked how she kind of, you know, worked with that trope of the, like the fact that like these old women are just like just stupid old women who have nothing better to do, when really like yeah, I don't know. I like that Miss Marple was talking a lot about how, you know, like these observations tell you a lot about life and people in general, and people are the same, like no matter where you are, really. It doesn't make small town life stupid or dull or whatever. Like observing people can tell you about people. And so it made it seem like not the stupid trope of like gossiping old biddies. And then there's also the one detective who kept saying things about like every time they got a letter or whatever from an old woman, he would be like, ugh, old women, they're just so blah 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 or whatever, and yeah. then it's, you know, proven wrong because they turn out to be quite helpful. So
yeah I liked that. And I liked Miss Marple's relationship with her nephew Raymond West, uh-huh. the detective writer,
yeah,
because she ends up like in the end, after she explains to the police exactly how everything went down, you know, she is going to go home and like tell her nephew, just to sort of keep score, like she's got one up on him.
Yes.
Because he figured it out before the actual detective writer did. Oh, I will say that there was some of the plot points where I was like, oh, this is a bit coincidental, like how they figured out from a handwriting expert.
Oh, yeah.
That it wasn't Prothero's handwriting. And it's like, okay, well, now we know handwriting experts are fake news.
Sure, but tell that to the internet sleuthing community.
Yeah. Yeah. But and then it was such a big thing that they figured it out, and it sort of happened off screen, you know?
Yeah.
Which was a little bit not my favorite reveal of a major
right.
plot point.
No. And I think a lot of that like does tend to happen in these sorts of stories, is like, you know, because so much of it is dialogue and going and talking to other people and like compiling evidence, that like a bunch of convenient things do tend to happen to be able to move stuff along. I mean, mm-hmm. it's also like, of course, there are red herrings or whatever, which I think is what you get with like Dr. Stone or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But then like still everything does fall into like a perfect place, like with the pyrrhic acid and the giant stone that Lawrence yeah. takes to Mrs. Marple because he gets caught carrying a giant stone. And just so happens that Mrs. Marple has Japanese gardens and he thinks that she'd like that stone for her Japanese garden. So, yeah, I think those things are like, I don't know, just very funny and convenient, too. But
yeah,
but in a way, it's like it's charming, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. One thing I loved is like the way that people are described. One of the first ones is it's really early on. He is in his study trying to get stuff done and Lettice walks in and they wind up talking about Ms. Cram, who is the first Gladys. He says, "It occurred to me that Lettice Prothero is somewhat of a minx. I wondered how she would get on with the archaeologist's secretary, Miss Cram. Miss Cram is a healthy young woman of 25, noisy in manner, with high color, fine animal spirits, and a mouth that always seems to have more than its full share of teeth."
Yes.
First of all, like, there's something about, like, this class of British people at this point in history where, like, they're always describing people as, like, animal spirits. And they're always using these words that, like, now have, like, a weird, vaguely sexual tone mm-hmm. to them that I don't quite know if they were always meant that way. But, like, you know, the number of times that Miss Marple calls the vicar naughty and, like, he describes a 17-year-old as a minx and, you know, animal spirits and all of these things. It's like,
yeah,
I don't know if I'm supposed to find it funny or if it's just become funny over the years. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Well, even like sometimes I just don't know what the description means. Like saying like she's a healthy young woman. Uh-huh. I feel like that's sort of a phrase that comes up in a lot of books around this time period and older. And I don't know what that looks like.
Is
like
that,
what am I supposed to think?
Is it a euphemism for like fat or whatever? Like I never quite know what we're dealing with. So yeah, with high color. What does that mean?
Yeah.
She blushing all the time? I just like the mouth with more than its full share of teeth because it makes me think of Dr. Teeth from The Muppets. So
another sort of funny thing is with the Miss Marple's nephew, the writer of detective stories, the vicar describes him as saying or as he does write detective stories, doesn't he?
I don't think he does because he acts like detective stories are so passe or something like that at some point.
That's right. Okay. Well, strike all that I said. He's just a writer.
Yeah.
Because now I'm looking at something I highlighted and it's the vicar saying about his writing. His poems have no capital letters in them, which is, I believe, the essence of modernity. His books are about unpleasant people leading lives of surpassing dullness. And number one, it's hilarious that no matter what, everybody hates modern art.
Yeah, I also like that he's basically, who is that poet?
E.E. Cummings.
Yeah, E.E. Cummings. I was going to say E.B. White. I was like, yes. That's definitely not it. Charlotte's Web guy.
Yeah, and then number two, the vicar apparently is not going to be reading like John Updike anytime soon.
Right.
Unpleasant people leading lives of surpassing dullness. Which I don't know, those are just the times where it's like such sharp writing because it is such an indictment on like what modern literary novels are generally about. Is boring people.
Yeah. I highlighted this part from that same dinner party because he says, "Murder is so crude." He said, "I take no interest in it." And then the vicar in his narration says, "That statement did not take me in for a moment. They say all the world loves a lover. Apply that saying to murder and you have an even more infallible truth. No one can fail to be interested in a murder. Simple people like Griselda and myself can admit the fact, but anyone like Raymond West has to pretend to be bored at any rate for the first 5 minutes." So yeah, that does kind of like tie back with what I was saying about this idea that like all people are just obsessed with murder or think it's exciting or something too. Mm-hmm. But also it's a nice dig at Raymond West because he's just like this boring city man who comes in and tries to rain on everybody's parade by being cooler than everyone there.
Yes. You have on here a note about the food that they
yes.
eat.
Yeah.
I also highlighted the blancmange, which is really good. I love that Mary, who is the vicar in Griselda's like housekeeper, cook, maid, mm-hmm. is terrible at doing everything. but they still keep her on because Griselda likes her, I guess.
She likes her, but she's also they're also worried that they'll never be able to afford like a good like maid person. So which is like a little bit awful because they're like, we need to keep this woman in our servitude and pay her less than other people would, because yeah it's just kind of like a weird classist cycle that's terrible,
yeah,
but also funny but also terrible.
But I do love that Mary clearly gives them what they deserve.
Oh yeah,
for doing that, which yeah. is terrible food and terrible housekeeping.
Yeah, the other food that I had highlighted was boiled beef. I think it was like the first chapter. Oh. And I was like, is that a real thing or is that just because she's bad? But then like the blancmange came up and I was like, still, that's disgusting. Maybe it's just because like English food isn't good. I say yeah. because it's not. But yeah, boiled beef is like, I can't think of like a worse sounding food.
No, maybe chipped beef. I don't know what that is.
I don't either.
That but... also sounds bad.
It's probably boiled still.
Yes.
So blancmange we first encountered in Little Women. And here's mm-hmm. the description from Google or Wikipedia for anybody who doesn't have our Little Women episode memorized. Blancmange is a sweet dessert commonly made with milk or cream and sugar, thickened with rice flour, gelatin, cornstarch, or Irish moss, and often flavored with almonds. It is usually set in a mold and served cold. Although traditionally white, blancmanges are frequently given alternative colors. I like looking at it like a traditional white blancmange. It looks like just like congealed milk, and it's probably jiggly. It looks repulsive. Like, it's pretty, mm-hmm. but it's not something you would ever want to put in your mouth. It looks like Elmer's glue that you like, you know, poured into something and let set. It's terrible. I hate it. And I think it even say, I think like it translates to just like white eat. So it's terrible.
Yeah. Well, and you can watch people make it on the Great British Bake Off.
Of course.
I can't remember what season it is, but I believe it's Prue's recipe and they make it and it doesn't look any better than how it sounds.
Oh, one thing I wanted to talk about that I found interesting, Dr. Haydock, he's the village doctor, essentially. He's basically like anti-police. Like, there's a couple of times where he's just basically out there saying ACAB. Let me find yes.
that. Yeah, that is funny. And how the vicar like actually just withholds information from Inspector Slack,
yeah.
because Slack is like not listening to him and he's being really rude. So the vicar is like, well, whatever, I'm not gonna tell you then.
Yeah. So here's a point where Haydock he's just talking to the vicar. He says, yes, we're a narrow-minded, self-righteous lot, only too keen to judge matters we know nothing about. I honestly believe crime is a case for the doctor, not for the policeman and not the parson. In the future, perhaps, there won't be any such thing. There's like a whole part. I mean, like, it's definitely like 1930s ideas of like what mental health is and stuff. But there is a part where it just kind of mm-hmm. goes into like, you know, at least discussing alternative reasons for crime other than people being evil, you know, which is, I don't know, it's an interesting topic to have come up. And I thought that was fascinating. Of course, Dr. Haydock does completely like flip his switch at the end of the novel and want the perpetrator to be, you know, brought to the fullest extent of the law. But it was a funny kind of little aside in the middle there.
Yeah. That was shocking to me that I just didn't really think about what would happen to the victims. Like, oh, they're going to go to British jail, you know?
Right.
And then it's like, they're going to get the gallows. And I was like, oh, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yikes.
Yeah, especially in this book that's like otherwise like very kind of humorous. Let's see. Do we want to talk about the crime itself?
Oh, yeah. Well, we haven't mentioned that at all.
No, we really haven't. Except for that, you know, he was murdered.
Yeah. So Prothero was murdered in the study at the vicarage. And he was murdered by his wife, his second wife, Anne Prothero. And with assistance from Lawrence Redding, who is a young man that she is having an affair with.
Yes. And he's kind of, I don't know, like everybody loves him. All of the women are kind of like in love with him, including the Anne's stepdaughter, Prothero's daughter. And so, yeah, I think my main culprit throughout the book, I assumed it was going to be Lettice, which I know I was supposed to think was what it was. But like, especially because they never really like fully considered her at all. So I was a little bit disappointed that it wasn't her.
Yeah. I also thought it would be Griselda.
Oh,
for a minute.
Yeah.
Especially when it came out that she was in love with Lawrence back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, oh, but that really sort of came up and went away really fast.
Yeah. And also, like, what would her motive be to kill him and not like somebody else in order to be with him, to be with Lawrence?
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know. Oh, my other thought was that maybe it was Dennis and Dennis did it for Lettice.
Yes, I thought about that too.
I wanted it to go into like a full-on like video games are corrupting our youth or something, because Dennis is so obsessed with detective stories. Which is like another like crossover with Little Women, is Joe writes detective stories and that's thought to be unbecoming of a young woman. So, yeah. I assume it was considered like smut at a certain point in history.
Yeah, it was shocking how once they like clear the body out of the room, anybody can just like waltz into the study at any time. Like Lettice goes in, drops some earrings to frame her stepmom. I mean, it's... Mary does not go in to dust, but she's supposed to be going in to dust.
Well, I mean, honestly, I know she's not a good housekeep, but if she doesn't want to go into the room where a man was just murdered to clean up after it, then I don't totally blame her. Because I think the other funny thing about these types of stories is just like the complete lack of realism in what would what a crime scene would look like if a person were literally shot through the head in a corner at a desk. Because basically when Len, the vicar, comes in and finds Prothero there dead at his desk, he's just got his head down on the desk and there's like a pool of dark liquid under him, and not like, you know, no splatter all over the walls or anything like that. Sorry to be crude, but yeah, it is sort of funny the way that it like sanitizes murder. Yeah, it's totally unrealistic.
It's also very funny that nobody hears the shot because there's a silencer on the gun. And this is a thing, not back then obviously, but even now people think silencers actually silence guns.
Yeah,
they do not. The movies make it sound like it's just a little like pew, but it's not. Guns are just that loud.
This one writes it off as a sneeze that like neighboring maid overheard. Yeah,
a weird sneeze that was definitely from a man.
Yes. Okay, it was a sneeze from a man. It is funny though. I mean, like I've mentioned before that I spend a lot of time like reading different threads on Reddit like about unresolved mysteries and murders and stuff, and it is kind of funny the way that like people do take these same sorts of approaches to like solving crimes that they know nothing about from the internet, you know. And so I just wonder how much of that is like is either natural or how much of it has been influenced by stories like these and like detective novels throughout time, which are all, you know, based on fiction. I don't know. It's fascinating to me.
Yeah. Have anything else?
I don't. You know what? I think I will read more Miss Marple stories. I like Miss Marple. We didn't talk about her a whole lot. She's a little bit cold, but I don't think she is. I think she's, you know, just slightly off-putting and weird, which is my favorite older woman to have in a book. It's like a funnier version of Drive Your Plows Over the Bones of the Dead, which is one of my favorite characters of all time. So
yeah, for sure. It's fun to read, especially like just if you don't take it too seriously. And it's nice that Miss Marple clearly like has her own life and is doing her own thing.
Yeah, and she's just smarter than everyone else. It's great.
And always, you know, underestimated.
Anyhow, if you've got any favorite Agatha Christie novels or other cozy mysteries. We chose Agatha Christie specifically because we weren't sure if it would be like alienating to go with like one of those ones about like muffins or whatever in the title. Let us know. I would still like to read one of the ones about, you know, muffin puns or whatever. So,
or that all revolve around a dog groomers or something like that.
Yes, absolutely. Ones that have like recipes for Jell-O or whatever in the back of them. Not Blancmange, though. You can let us know. But anyway, thanks for listening to The Bookstore.
If you would like to support the podcast beyond listening, you can check out our Patreon at patreon.com/thebookstore or rate and review us on Apple Podcasts.
You can find all of the ways to contact us. Our email, social media, and phone line are at thebookstorepodcast.com.
Our next book discussion will be Little Eyes by Samantha Schweblin. You can find it at your local bookstore or library and read along with us.
The Bookstore is a production of Awkwardly Social Media, produced by Becca Young and Corinne Keener. Technical and production support is provided by Josh Bourdon and Zach Titus.
And John, if you're out there, thanks for listening.
See you next Tuesday. Bye.